With your help, we can continue to fight for freedom, reach new audiences, and bring important information to the public free of charge. This is not possible without your generosity. Join our quest for the truth and our freedom and donate today. Simply go to tntradio.live. Perspective with Jesse Zurawell on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome to Perspective. I'm Jesse Zurawell, your host for the hour. Joining me once again today is Riley Wagaman, independent journalist who is currently based in Tbilisi, Georgia. Riley publishes frequently at his Substack, edwardslavsquat.substack.com. His original work there is frequently republished at offguardian.org, and he publishes semi-frequently, I suppose you could say, at unlimitedhangout.com as well. Riley, welcome back, brother. How are you?
Jesse, I'm doing all right. How are things over there?
Things over here are all right, but there's a lot to unpack in that all right. So I'll just leave it at that for now. Yeah. As always, let's talk about, as we always do, Russia and Ukraine and Eurasia at large, and start with the World Health Organization, the WHO, which last week wrapped up its 76th World Health Assembly, which it holds annually, the WHA. And Russia did not boycott this. It participated readily. And you wrote about this at your Substack in an article titled Moscow's WHO Masochism, Unpacking Russia's Performance at the 76th World Health Assembly. So how would you rate Russia's performance at the 76th WHA?
Well, that's a really good question. I would have to say, I mean, are we rating on a scale of one to what everyone else is saying, you know, about how important and health preserving the WHO is. If that's the rating system, Moscow did a wonderful job, because the deputy minister of health, this gentleman named Sergei Glagolev, if I'm recalling correctly, came up to the podium, and I would say probably 90% of his speech could have just been copy and pasted and said by any health minister or official from the West. And he praised, you know, he started off right out of the gate thanking the World Health Organization for helping to strengthen global health. Within the first few sentences, he talks about how important it is for member states of the WHO to pursue sustainable development goals. He praises China for its pandemic response, claiming that Beijing was an example to the world with how it helped out all over the globe with stopping the spread of coronavirus. He basically just went down all the talking points that we hear from all these other psychos all over the world. I guess just to wrap up my summary, it should be pointed out, though, that at the very end, this gentleman did say that Moscow strongly opposes this idea, the promotion of sort of transgender issues and this idea that there's more than two genders or sexes, and said that this was sort of an assault on traditional values and countries that are still socially conservative. But in general, I would have to say that the performance was concerning, and that's just not my opinion. As I explained in the article, that's really what all of the major prominent alternative voices in Russia were saying and concluded, that this was not really something to celebrate.
Right. I want to get into some of the details of what Glagolev said, but first ask you if you know anything about why he was addressing the World Health Assembly on behalf of both Moscow and Minsk.
Yeah, that is a good question. And I'm glad you brought that up. I don't have an answer to that. Maybe you do. But, you know, there is Russia and Belarus have been pursuing this sort of union state, you know, concept, which exists in some form with, you know, where basically both governments cooperate very closely to the point where there is this sort of informal union state relationship. But I can't really comment further on that.
I don't know the answer to that either. But it brings me back to what we talked about with regard to what Russia, on behalf of the Eurasian Economic Union, put forth with regard to the exact name of the entity is escaping me, but Russia put forth that this entity should be established in every country and it should more or less have the power to override any country's legislative body in the name of so-called public health. And this was information that James Roguski shared with me and I shared with you. The point being that in that submission, Russia was representing not just itself, but the members of the Eurasian Economic Union, which are 5 countries total, including Russia, if I'm not mistaken. So I don't know what the agreement is there among those countries in the Eurasian Economic Union, or what the agreement is between Russia and Belarus, but such was the way it was presented. So as you detail in your piece, Glagolev started by saying, quote, on behalf of the Union State of the Russian Federation and the Republic of Belarus, I have the honor to congratulate the member countries of the organization and all WHO employees on the anniversary of our organization and note its role in strengthening the health of the world's population, unquote. Underneath that, you wrote, the WHO is, quote, strengthening the health of the world's population, unquote, citation desperately needed, which, as I've told you before, I always appreciate your sense of humor, but a citation is desperately needed for that. And I will wager that there is no citation for that to be found.
Yeah, no, I don't think there is either. Definitely not.
But this right here out of the gate in Glagolev's speech speaks to the fealty, I suppose you could say, or the adulation, perhaps both, perhaps there's more involved here, that Russia has for the WHO, at least in its words, but I think in its actions too. And when you consider that the WHO is a global governance body in which the so-called satanic West plays an outsized role, perhaps the biggest role, questions start to arise as to, again, what's going on in the context of the war in Ukraine, which I suppose we can say is a war in Russia also, given the strikes that have been happening inside of Russia's borders. So just putting that out there, if you have anything to say to that, please do.
I think you nailed it there, Jesse. Yeah.
So excuse me, with regard to sustainable development goals, Glagolev said, "We hope that this organization and its member states are able to develop and achieve their goals, primarily the SDGs, sustainable development goals, progress towards which has been slowed down by the coronavirus pandemic." When I read that in your piece, it immediately brought to mind something I read a few days before you published your piece. And this was a summary of statements made by Tedros, who's the director general of the WHO at the World Health Assembly. And this was published by the UN on its official website. Under an article titled "World Must Be Ready to Respond to Next Pandemic," WHO chief. And Tedros said many interesting, to say the least, things. But one of the things he said that jumped out at me before I read your piece, and especially so afterward, is, quote, "The pandemic has blown us off course, but it has shown us why the SDGs must remain our North Star and why we must pursue them with the same urgency and determination with which we countered the pandemic," unquote, he said. Very similar to what Glagolev said, almost a parroting that went on the part of Russia. And I think what's important here is both that the Russian representative is saying almost the exact same thing that Tedros is saying, but also homing in on sustainable development goals. And when we look at what sustainable development goals are, they, of course, are sold to us as goals that need to be pursued to save the planet and create equity for everyone and inclusivity for everyone. But there are guidelines for global economic transformation, and not a transformation that is in favor of the people of the world, let's say. There directions as to how to transform the international monetary and financial system under the guise of saving the planet, but pushing the IMFS in a direction that those who are pushing it understand it needs to go, because the old way of doing things, the way we've known up until now, is on its way out, to put it mildly. So here's how we're going to create new industries and new markets, and here's how we're going to modify and commodify people's behavior in service of doing so. Because if people understand what this is all about, they're not going to want to have anything to do with it. So what I'm getting at here is that Russia, by its own admission, or at least by the admission of its WHO representative, is not just fully on board with the WHO's public health madness, but also sustainable development goals, that agenda, which is a part of Agenda 2030, as well as is the collective satanic West. So again, what is going on here is a question we have to ask, but I think we know the answer to that. But I'd like to get your take on this. Even though we've talked about this many times before, it's still a conversation we need to keep having.
Well, I think we could probably talk about a long time about what sustainable development means in practice and what it represents. But for me, it just seems like an austerity scam, you know, just neoliberalism that's been packaged up in this nice little friendly bow. And so it's not something that I'm really very excited about. And I don't think anybody should be excited about, whether you're Russian or French or Brazilian or American or whatever. So yeah, if you're concerned about this trend, then you should recognize that Moscow is also on board with it.
And as you point out in your article, this was the second sentence of Glagolev's speech in which the SDGs were brought up. So that speaks to me to the importance of pursuing this agenda. And when we look around the world, literally around the world, we have Russia on board with this, China on board with this, Saudi, for example, with its Saudi Vision 2030, the EU, the UK, the US, Canada, every country has some sort of program in place to pursue this agenda. And it flies in the face of the narrative that you and I are always talking about and unpacking, that Russia is in an existential fight, not just against the West, but against globalism. How, if that's the case, then do you explain this? And sadly, people have very embarrassing ways of trying to explain this away or dissembling, but here we have.
Yeah, I think that. Oh, no, please.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say, in general, I think there's this trend where people, there's a lot of attempts at sort of rationalizing things that really can't be rationalized because they're not rational, and doing their best not to just employ the same sort of standards that we use to pick apart policies promoted in the West, which, by the way, is a very important thing to do. But I do think that the tools and the critical thinking that is used to think critically about the West are very rarely employed when discussing Beijing and Moscow. And I would even say just these sort of larger organizations that have been presented to us as some sort of alternative to the Western system, such as BRICS. So that's been an ongoing problem, I would say.
Right. Following the remark about SDGs, Glagolev said, quote, "We note that over the past 3 years, the pandemic has been an unprecedented challenge to the whole world, revealing many problems and vulnerabilities. Unfortunately, in overcoming the current pandemic, when the highest degree of cohesion, mutual assistance, coherence of actions, and the rejection of selfish practices were required, some countries preferred to look for the guilty and politicize the situation. Nevertheless, despite all the difficulties and problems that have been revealed, the world managed to cope with this severe blow and save millions of lives, which became possible only thanks to mutual support and cooperation," unquote. And your response to that in the article, which I think is extremely important, and as far as I can tell, you are the only person in English language alternative media who's talking about this. You point out Russia's natural population decline totaled more than 1 million people in 2021, a figure that hasn't been seen since 1945. This impressive crime was accomplished by suspending routine medical care, forcing an unproven genetic injection on the population, and by waging a sustained campaign of socioeconomic terrorism in the form of QR codes, arbitrary restrictions on businesses, etc. And again, that's so important because it's pointed out, rightly so, about population declines and excess mortality in the West. The excess mortality in the UK has been horrific for many months now. But when it comes to Russia, this is never, ever pointed out. And it's it's not just Kremlin partisans who ignore this. It's people who don't seem to have a partisan stance, if you will, who I don't think they're ignoring it. They just aren't aware of it. And I don't know why this isn't bigger news. This really has nothing to do with the fact that it's Russia. We're talking about a massive population decline of human beings. No matter where it is, it should be on everybody's radar.
Totally. And, you know, all of this very horrific loss of life, has been compounded on top of a pre-existing demographic catastrophe, I would say, for Russia. And so while the numbers for 2022 were better, I mean, they returned to what I would say pre-COVID population decline. Still population declining, quite significant, but not a million people. The problem, though, is that this issue is not going away anytime soon. And it's an absolutely critical issue for Russia's survival as a nation. And it's so interesting to me how Russia is held up as this example, I would say, especially in sort of conservative right-wing circles, as, you know, the country that respects and protects family values and traditional values. Well, okay, that sounds great on paper, but if your population is rapidly declining and you imposed forcefully public health measures that are destroying public health, for me, this is just hot air. You know, it's sort of like it's the U.S. president saying that they're working on creating more jobs when it's really just, you know, McDonald's or whatever. So, again, I feel like this is a very, very important issue. And you are quite correct to point out it's very strange that for whatever reason in Western alternative media, we don't see it discussed in any way. Don't forget about nuance. This is not even brought up.
Right. And again, it's not a political or partisan issue at the end of the day. Wherever this is happening, it should be pointed out. Now, has Moscow been responding to this at all? Has it been taking any measures to try to mitigate this? Go ahead, please.
So, yeah, there are government programs that have been in place, but if you consult what conservative sources as well as left-wing independent sources in Russia, what you'll find is that there's a broad agreement within sort of Russia's independent media space that these policies are not doing anything positive. That I don't have the details on the top of my head. Katusha, one of the outlets that I really respect and cite often, recently published an article about it, which I haven't looked at in close detail, but just from glancing at it, it looked quite damning. And I think the larger point here is that these programs that have been promoted by the Kremlin in an attempt to either stop or, in the best case scenario, reverse this population decline have really done nothing. And in fact, at this point, I believe Dmitry Peskov, who is Russia's presidential spokesman, came out and basically said, this is an insurmountable problem. The situation is not getting better. This is not things that a government would say if things were under control. I think that's a fair assessment.
So many things to be said about this and what's going on outside of it as well. What, at least if you watch, RT, or if you read TASS or a lot of Western alternative media, they talk about how Russia's doing or supposedly doing these grand things in Africa or developing the Eurasian Economic Union, and there's activity buzzing in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, et cetera, et cetera. But back at home, there's this, there really is an existential crisis going on, and it's like shoulders are being shrugged by the likes of Peskov, and I haven't heard Lavrov speak about this or Zakharova, and maybe it's not within their remit to speak about this, but I'm also not surprised that these clowns aren't speaking about it either.
Well, such is life. What can we do, Jesse? We just have to stay true to ourselves, keep chugging along.
Yeah, but again, I just want to point out, here's an existential crisis that Russia is facing, and those who are daily screaming about Russia fighting an existential fight against the West are essentially completely mum about this, and that's some pretty disgusting hypocrisy that they would do well to address. Just my humble suggestion. Glagolev goes on to say in his speech, as you pointed out, quote, "We especially welcome the work of the PRC, People's Republic of China, on a timely and effective response to the pandemic and large-scale assistance to states in need," unquote. And your response in the article is one word, horrifying. And I agree, because if we look at the, let's just look at the origins, if you will, of the invented pandemic. The origins, if we go to the fraudulent papers to prove, in inverted commas, that there was a new and novel coronavirus causing a new and novel disease that eventually became COVID-19. Those first papers were produced in China, and one simply needs to go to the methods section to discover that they did not isolate or purify or identify anything new or novel or contagious. They made something up in a computer when it comes down to brass tacks, and then shared that around the world. And that started off the 3+ year nightmare we've all been living through. So to say that, to praise the work of the PRC on a timely and effective response to the pandemic and large-scale assistance to states in need is indeed horrifying. Anything you'd like to add to that besides horrifying?
I would like to add something very quickly, which is I think that you could even make the case, pragmatic case, where maybe in a situation where China just sort of did its own thing, which I strongly oppose on many different levels, but was very sort of apolitical or indifferent or ambivalent to how the rest of the world handled this alleged pandemic. Okay, that's a different thing. Beijing launched a propaganda campaign to lock down the entire world. There are examples where, for example, when Sweden refused to lock down, Sweden was viciously attacked by Beijing state media, as well as their very, very sympathetic followers and I would say directly and indirectly linked pundits. There was a orchestrated campaign coming from China to make the Chinese model of dealing with the so-called pandemic universal, which in my opinion is deplorable and disgusting. So when Russia talks about how China is a model of how the world responded to this pandemic, that's horrifying, as I said, in one word.
Right. And that it's disingenuous to pin it all on China. And I'm not saying that's what you're doing by any means.
Yeah, I agree completely.
Because this was carried out globally. It did have a starting point. And interestingly, what few people realize, and I didn't realize this until very recently when I spoke with the independent writer and researcher Michael Bryant, who's published at Off Guardian as well. He did a piece on Italy's early days response to the so-called pandemic. And Italy was actually the first country in the world to lock down on a systematic level, even before China did. And that discrepancy in the narrative that it started in China and then moved to other parts of the world is one that is forgotten and was perhaps lost in the fray of chaos and propaganda and fear and lies of early 2020. But China still played a huge part in this, especially if we look at the foundational papers to create this idea of a so-called new and novel virus producing a so-called new and novel disease that was of so-called pandemic proportions. That goes back largely to scientists in China, the Chinese CDC, and there's no escaping that fact. So again, to laud China as an example of anything with regard to the COVID-19 operation is indeed horrifying, but there's Russia's stance on it. And there's a lot that can be said too with regard to why Russia is making such a statement, because it's widely thought that Russia and China are blood brother allies, but their relationship isn't as close as it's often made out to be, particularly by many in Western alternative media. And perhaps that's something we can touch on, but first we need to throw it to a quick pause. And after this pause, I will be back to speak more about this madness with Riley Wagaman. Hang tight.
Mark Morano on TNT Radio.
France flight bans. This story has blown up now internationally. Spain, Austria, Germany, other countries now looking at this. Greenpeace is calling for an EU-wide 6-hour ban on flights 6 hours or shorter. This is truly what climate lockdowns look like. This is truly what the Great Reset looks like. It's happening, it's here, and we have to deal with it. So I was on Fox News, I was on News Max, I was on One America, I was on The First TV on their climate communism special, which I even told the host, Jesse Kelly. And a few years ago, I would have been uncomfortable calling it climate communism because you'd look like a red baiter and you were just being alarmist. But actually, since March of 2020, you know, and seeing just the naked agenda of what they're proposing, climate communism is not an incorrect term. It is actually a very apt term, and it is incredible how language has shifted. I mean, that would have been, that was an extreme comment or extreme label a few years ago.
The Mark Morano Show on today's News Talk Radio, TNT.
Affordable housing, we can build that. Sustainable housing, we can build that. At MIT Modular, we understand the importance of housing for all and the importance of design, cost, and functionality. Our goal is to meet the needs of our growing population by converting shipping containers to livable units. If you're like-minded and in a position to invest in something meaningful and life-changing, we want to hear from you. We are a team of professional architects, engineers, and financial and tax experts dedicated to offering unique solutions that provide a brighter future. Our Opportunity Zone Fund offers investors both real estate and operating business diversification, 5-year tax deferral on capital gains, annual tax benefits, and ultimately tax-free appreciation potential. There are opportunity zones all over America. If you're interested in learning more about our services, need affordable housing, or want to participate in creating a new vision for tomorrow, give us a call in the U.S. on 385-985-5702 or read more at mitmodular.com. MIT Modular. We can build that.
This is Jesse Zurawell and Perspective on today's News Talk, TNT Radio.
Welcome back to Perspective here on TNT Radio, where we are live 24/7. I'm Jesse Zurawell, and I'm speaking with independent writer, journalist Riley Wagaman, who is joining me from the fine city of Tbilisi, Georgia. And we are talking about Russia's performance at the WHO's recently wrapped World Health Assembly, the 76th one. We were just talking about Russia, or the Russian representative to the World Health Assembly, praising China for its so-called pandemic response. And Riley, I pointed out that this, one would read this and on the surface think, okay, well, this is part and parcel of Russia and China's close alliance. But as you and others have pointed out, I think Rolo Slavsky has pointed this out as well, that when you really look at the relationship between Russia and China, they're not allies and they're not as close as they're made out to be. For example, China does not recognize the sovereignty, if you will, of the new territories of the Russian Federation. So Donbass, Kherson, Zaporozhye. And that's important.
Yeah, it's such a massive topic, and it's one that I've been meaning to write about for a long time. Honestly, I'm afraid to write about it just because I feel like the backlash is going to be so enormous. But the reality is that this sort of dragon bear alliance meme is just it's just not really true. It's a very complicated relationship, and I'm not suggesting that there aren't close relations in many areas. There definitely are. In fact, economic ties are definitely increasing. But you are absolutely right to point out that if Beijing is Russia's close ally, it would be behaving in a very different way. There was this incredible interview, I want to say maybe a month ago, that was published by the New York Times. And maybe you're familiar with it, and correct me if I'm getting this wrong, but I believe it was a top Chinese diplomat who is stationed in the European Union. I forget the exact title. But anyway, this guy sat down with the New York Times, and he gave this incredible interview where he said, look, this idea that Russia and China have a friendship that has no limits, or an unbreakable friendship, I forget the exact terminology. He said, that's just rhetoric. That's absolutely just rhetoric. We absolutely have lines in the sand with Moscow. We're not bending over backwards to support Russia and in various ways. Beijing has repeatedly denied providing any kind of military assistance to Russia during this conflict. And look, possibly there are some kinds of weapon systems or hardware that's sneaking into Russia from China, but there's really not a lot of evidence for it. And if it is happening, right, it must be on a very, very small scale. So I just want to point that out. I'm not saying that it's impossible. Maybe they are doing it through a back door. And also, Beijing has been very, very sensitive to Western sanctions and complying with them. And again, even if there are sort of back doors, in general, Beijing has been compliant with Western sanctions directed unilaterally imposed on Moscow. So there's a lot of nuances to this relationship. It's not so black and white as people paint it as. And frankly, I think this is important to point out. Many, many hardline sort of patriotic Russians are very distrustful of Beijing. And in fact, you can go back even to 2014 and you'll find commentaries talking about how the big winner in the Ukraine crisis is Beijing. because what it has done is severed economic cooperation and ties between Russia and the West. And now Beijing gets discounted Russian resources. And this has definitely been the case over the last 2 years, even more so than it was back about 10 years ago. So, and also a lot of Russians, again, it's not that they are anti-Chinese per se, but they point out the very, very enormous cultural and social differences between the two countries and say, look, an alliance with China, even if it did happen, doesn't make sense on a lot of levels. We're just very, very different countries.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And not that it needs to be pointed out, but I'll point it out anyway. What we're talking about here are the governments or power structures
in these
countries, not the people themselves. And that often gets lost in the conversation as well. Well, oh, okay, you're saying that all Chinese people or no Chinese people think this way or act that way. Same with Russian people, Russian citizens. No, it's not what we're saying. We're talking about the power structures that think they or declare that they represent all of the people they, I would say, arbitrarily lord over. But that's a whole other discussion unto itself. But again, we're talking about the power structures here.
Yeah, and let me just briefly say, for example, one actually common critique that you find is that actually a lot of people who think that this Russia-China partnership doesn't make sense are hardcore, like basically neo-Soviet Marxists who say China's economic model and Russia's economic model makes no sense because we're controlled by oligarchs and China is a communist country, which I don't think is actually true. I think it's a lot more complicated than that. But what they're actually arguing is, why would China want to be involved with a country that is basically polluted by, you know, Western bootlicking oligarchs?
Mm-hmm.
Which is quite an extraordinary thing to say. But in my opinion, I think it's basically oligarchy controls everything, but whatever. Different discussion.
Yeah, that is, I think, inarguably true. But speaking of power structures, let's talk about the Russian representative to the WHO's statements about the injections. He said, quote, "We cannot help but pay attention to the large-scale facts of corruption that are being revealed around pharmaceutical giants, related, among other things, to the desire to limit the drug market, turning it into an elite club, in inverted commas, depriving the population of countries of the opportunity to access the latest drugs at affordable prices. Attention is also drawn to the growing concern about the safety of pre-qualified vaccines, which requires close study with the formation of appropriate conclusions and improvement of market authorization procedures," unquote. So before I ask for your take on this, I'll just say that a big part of this statement is exactly what the WHO has been screaming about since the injections were rolled out in late 2020, which is that we need to have so-called vaccine equity, and we need to get these poisons into low and middle income countries, into developing countries, because the people there are just clamoring for these poisons, aren't they? So there's a repeating of that horrific nonsense, I would call it. But then there's also the hypocrisy in this of talking about safety of pre-qualified vaccines and improvement of market authorization procedures. And you and I have talked about Sputnik V and its partnership with AstraZeneca and what has resulted from that injection. in Russia, and you recently spoke with a Russian doctor, and you published this in another article on your Substack, and it's a quote from her. I believe it's from her. Russian medicine is controlled by the WHO, a conversation with Russia's Independent Association of Doctors. You spoke with Dr. Alina Lushevina, who is the head of that association. And so in the context of the statements made by Glagolev and the Sputnik V, but also other injections that were rolled out in Russia, and the hypocrisy of Glagolev's statements about proper safety studies. These things aren't needed at all, but in his paradigm of speaking, they are needed because viruses exist and this is how we combat viruses, blah, blah, blah. But I'm interested to hear about your conversation with Dr. Lushevina and her response to all of this. And I think as you laid out in your interview with her, what she has to say is echoed by a lot of Russian citizens as well, regardless of where they are on the political spectrum or ideological spectrum.
Yeah, exactly. And she's part of this basically a neo-Soviet political movement in Russia. But as I pointed out, it doesn't matter whether you're far left or far right or somewhere in the center. I challenge anyone to find me an independent outlet in Russia, you know, non-mainstream, that is willing to carry water for Sputnik V or for Russia's COVID policies, or even for the WHO, just as a organization and its influence over Russia. And the interview was, for me, it was really, really interesting. I hope that my readers felt similarly. But she basically just talked about how, she just talked about how her organization for the, since the very first days of COVID has been trying to work through the Russian legal system, you know, trying to do everything by the book to, at the very least, just get some transparency and accountability for what's going on. And as she points out, just repeatedly, this their requests for information about Sputnik V, about people who have been in fully vaccinated and have later died, the composition of Sputnik V, what's actually in the drug. I pointed to another request from a doctor who asked for the latest phase 3 trials of Sputnik V, which have been kept from the public for reasons which I cannot comprehend, and other things, as well as lawsuits, by the way, to stop the compulsory vaccination policies at the regional level and mask mandates. Everything was blocked. Everything was stonewalled. Everything was rejected. And at the end of the article, she just basically states, look, when we would write to these health officials in the Ministry of Defense and ask them, you know, why are you doing this? There's no evidence for this. They would get an answer back saying, we're following WHO recommendations. It's like, it's not even our decision. I mean, who knows what the exact wording is, but that's how she described it. So there it is. Take it or leave it. I fully concede that there's a wide range of perspectives on this. You're going to get slightly different answers depending on who you ask about these issues, but I guarantee that across the political spectrum, every single prominent Russian activist or commentator or even doctor who's been talking about this doesn't support Russia's membership in the WHO, doesn't think that Sputnik is safe or effective, and wants answers from Russia's Ministry of Health.
I want to say that this, what she and her colleagues have been trying to do going through the legal system, and the response they've received points to the futility of doing so. Which is not to say that all efforts should be given up, but there are very similar efforts being made in the US and in the EU. And I don't think that they're ultimately going to go anywhere. And that's not me being a nihilist or a pessimist. It's being a realist, which I know Rolo Slavsky often says that being a realist and a pessimist go hand in hand. And I do tend to agree with that. But what is important, though, is the effort that's being made. And it's also, I think, important to point out that she made statements in the interview which I don't agree with in terms of the science, in terms of so-called virology. And that's a conversation we should have. But what's important here, and you emphasize this in your piece, is that there's a concerted pushback against this democidal campaign, this global democidal campaign, and there's a huge one in Russia, and it's not something we should just be aware of. We should also champion it. But I think too, and I'm almost sure there are people within this movement who would agree that we need to have the conversation too about what I see, and others as well, as the core of this democidal campaign, which is the fraud of contagion, that people make each other sick. But I think the point I'm trying to make here is that although I disagree with her on some of the science she puts forth, I wholeheartedly support and very much respect the work she's done. And I think it's important and by no means should be dismissed or put down simply because she has a, I don't want to say opinion because I think we're talking about facts here, but she has a more traditional allopathic sense of medicine and science. And I think we have to, as somebody who understands what I argue is the reality that viruses have never been proven to exist and do not make people sick, etc., that we have to try to find ways to come together with people who are doing really important work, who are our allies, who are in solidarity with us, and bridge these gaps and be able to have those conversations instead of getting militant about things and dismissive about things. So not really a question there, but just something I wanted to point out. But you did highlight something to this extent in your piece, and I thought it was, I think it's one of the key aspects of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, look, you know, I think that with any sort of highly contentious issue, you're going to find people who are sort of in different stages along their journey to digging down to the, you know, the truth of the matter, the heart of the matter. And I would just say, just as someone, I'm just not talking about virology or COVID or anything, you know, my journey as someone who has been thinking about and writing about and covering Russia has been, I mean, we're talking about night and day differences over a period of 4 years or less, actually, really. And so I think it's important to try to create environments where people can have these kind of sort of journeys, right? Where you can explore ideas and come to your own conclusions and not be, you know, no, we don't need finger wagging, right? We just need to be able to find points of agreement and work from there. And I guarantee that if people are given the space and sort of a supportive public forum where people aren't judged for having different opinions, that eventually truth will prevail. I really do believe that. But it has to be done in a way where people don't feel threatened or bullied into certain feeling a certain way or believing certain things.
Yes, very well said, and I completely agree. Riley, so much more we could talk about as always, but unfortunately we are out of time. Thank you very much for joining me today for this conversation, and I am already looking forward to our next one, which I hope is soon.
It's always a pleasure, Jesse. Thanks for having me on, man.
My pleasure. And that's it for me for today. I will be back at the same time tomorrow. Stay tuned for Joe Hoft coming up next here on TNT Radio. Take care.